From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for November 4th, 2022. The Bucks have just one home game this week. OKC rides into the Forum this Saturday night. The Packers are looking to snap their four-game losing streak in Detroit this Sunday. And on the heels of Halloween, today is National Candy Day, sponsored by your local dentists. Elon Musk bought Twitter for $44 billion last week and promptly fired the existing management group. Now, 1 week later, he laid off half the workforce by email, which is pretty cold. In the Bay Area, the home of Twitter, for years the hottest Halloween costume was Spider-Man. So what does one have to do with the other? The hot new costume this year was a laid-off Twitter employee carrying boxes full of personal items out to the car. You don't suppose Elon carries a grudge, do you? We live in a very litigious society, and Your Honor, I have proof. Exhibit A, a California cannabis company, is being sued by two local consumers. Is that what they're calling them now, consumers? Well, Bill and Ted are suing the dispensary for allegedly lying about potency of its product. Exhibit B, another pair of Californians bought Barilla Pasta, thinking it was made in Italy. It's not, so they're suing. And finally, Exhibit C, another Californian sued Texas Pete Hot Sauce because it's really made in North Carolina. I think this is an issue of, this is an indictment of judicial system and not an indictment of the California school system. A 94-year-old Iranian man hasn't bathed or showered or used soap and water in 60 years. He was easy to find even in the dark. Well, he finally caved into social pressure and took a bath, and he died a month later. Apparently, dirt was the only thing holding them together. And finally, if you're looking to fill some time while you're on a Zoom call, check this out. Costco is selling the world's largest jigsaw puzzle. It's 8 feet by 29 feet, has 60,000 pieces, and it costs just short of $600. A Zoom call seems like the perfect time to look for those corner pieces. On the podcast today, we have Dave Sandstrom, Adam Bailey, Joel Driesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks a bunch, Max. We always got a parenting tip that if our kids were fighting, you make them do a jigsaw puzzle together, and that's a good way to make them force themselves to get along. Not sure that's going to be the best bet with that Costco one. Maybe some more fights there trying to figure out what's what. Maybe a couple of fights this week in the market trying to figure out what's what. The NASDAQ down 5.6% this week on the heels of a Fed announcement that we'll talk about in a minute. The S&P down 3.3%, closing today at 3771. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 1.4%, closing at 32405. For the year, the Dow down 9.4%, the NASDAQ down 32.6%, a pretty huge discrepancy there, and falling somewhere in the middle of the broad market, S&P 500 down 19.9%. Well, you know, Dave, we come off the heels of what was an incredibly strong October, the kind of middle of the market, Russell 1000 or S&P 500 up a little better than 8%. Some significant discrepancies still kind of between that value and growth conversation, but what really caught everyone's attention and what we were all really waiting for was what the Fed had to say this week on Wednesday. We got more or less what we expected in terms of the interest rate increase, but maybe some news on kind of the next steps, and that caused the market to go into a bit of a tailspin.
You know, Kyle, what was interesting to me was I was wondering if Chair Powell maybe went off script a little bit, because in his prepared remarks, he stuck to the three-quarter point increase, and yes, we're going to slow our pace. It wasn't until the questioning started later that he floated this whole kind of direction about we might have to go much higher than we had originally thought. So it was kind of interesting. It was early in that, if you're watching the markets closely, early in his prepared remarks, the market was going up substantially. And then as soon as he got into his comments about we're going to go higher than we thought, we obviously saw a pretty significant sell-off. So Kind of interesting there. I don't know if he's just doubling down on his tough rhetoric here just to try to drive that point home that the Fed is very serious about inflation, and they're not announcing any victory just yet.
You know, Dave, I think with like the rhetoric that they have, that the hawkish rhetoric, I think you mentioned this a couple weeks ago, that just by mere mentioning this, they might not have to do so much rate increases in the future, just kind of setting expectations. And they did open the door to a pivot, acknowledging that, all right, they're going to slow their rate increases at some point in the future. At some point, they'll have to pause. That's not coming today. But you just got to wonder if, you know, he was purposeful with his words, and just that the hawkish tone really does set expectations and maybe means they don't have to raise rates further down the road.
Well, and I think when you look at the direction the yield curve has taken, right, this expectation of what's happening in the immediate future versus what's the market really think is happening down the road, we've seen a substantial shift in rates for kind of the year to 18-month, even the two-year window, higher. You can get 4.8 now on an 18-month treasury. Of course, if you're looking out 10 years, the 10-year treasury didn't really jump all that much this week. And I think that's maybe the thing that stands out a bit to me. And Dave, I know it's something you've pointed out. The market just doesn't see long-term a huge move higher from rates.
Yeah, and the markets, I think the bond market in particular has seemed to be a little bit more orderly, I guess I'd say, than the stock market this year. The pricing has been quick, obviously, the repricing based on the Fed's actions, but it hasn't been a kind of a up and down, all over the place kind of a thing. I mean, you know, we've had a steady increase, of course, and we did peak back a couple weeks ago in October at 4.25. But you're right, Kyle, this week's announcement, the bond market kind of took that in stride, I think.
Well, and I think that's the key, right, is that at some point in time, the Fed does signal an all clear. And maybe, you know, based on Paul's comments this week, whether it's just bluster and trying to remind people, hey, we're still in control, or whether it's that they actually will need to, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. Yeah, maybe the tunnel's a little longer. Maybe it takes us a little while longer to get there, and there's a few more hurdles along the way. But we know that there's an end to this. We know that there's a point in time at which rates start to, you know, stabilize. And so I think that's the key, is as we look ahead, you know, inflation isn't a concern for the markets long term. The Treasury break-even inflation rates, 2.5% on the 5-year and the 10-year, not all that significantly above what the Fed kind of is targeting long term. And so I think it's clear the market believes that the Fed's going to win. I think it's clear that the market believes that there is an end. And, you know, I think we only heard this week from the Fed what we already knew, which is they're going to continue to rely on the data to determine when all this ends. You know, I think the other piece of this is, you know, we like to place blame as far as the inflationary pressure on politicians, on the Fed, on whatever it is, a reminder that inflation is a global problem, that certainly in much of the rest of the world, inflation is higher than it is here in the U.S., and yet much of the rest of the world late to the game in terms of raising interest rates. It's one of the reasons why the dollar's been as strong as it has. And yet, Dave, the Bank of England may be finally starting to take some action.
Yeah, kind of a strange reaction all along, really. We were kind of waiting for, you know, okay, what, you know, they were hitting 10% record inflation numbers, and yet not a big reaction there, not a lot of conversation even about it. So interesting today to see him roll out a quick three quarter point increase, kind of matching the Fed here in the U.S. with a little bit more aggressive stance. So it'll be interesting to see where they go in their subsequent meetings and direction. But you'd have to think that they're probably embarking on a pretty aggressive trajectory at this point.
It'll also be interesting to see where the dollar goes. If they continue to raise interest rates, at some point we're going to slow here, maybe pause down the road. And if they're just picking up steam, you know, that could really change the direction of the dollar. And that's one of the things that we've talked about before, is that the dollar's been stubbornly high, and it does impact earnings. You know, one of the things, if you've been listening to the conference calls and the quarterly earnings reports for, you know, CEOs of large global multinational businesses, call after call, it's been the dollar is impacting earnings, right? I mean, it's just less competitive trying to do business overseas when, you know, the price of your goods and services are that much more expensive just because of the currency piece.
Well, and I think the earnings season that we're in has been an interesting one in part because earnings have been so challenged by the strength of the dollar, in part because inflation has weighed. And then you look at, okay, well, what's making money? It's been energy stocks largely. That absent energy names, you'd be largely in an earnings recession right now. And I think the reality is it actually sets up fairly nicely for the comparison into future quarters because earnings are as weak as they are in so many areas of the market. We're 85% through earnings season right now. And as I said, we're thinking, you know, absent energy, it's probably an earnings recession. And with energy, maybe you get a 4-4.5% year-over-year earnings growth for the quarter. So, you know, if energy's doing all the heavy lifting, energy's not that big of the S&P 500, you get an idea of just how significant the earnings increases have been there. A reminder that one of the big reasons is the oil companies, that if the price of oil goes up, their input costs don't change all that drastically, but they get the benefit of those profits. And so, you know, I think it's clear that the energy names have been the one that's done all the heavy lifting. Adam, the thing that we talked about quite a bit was how obvious inflation was in the energy sector. You drive down the street, you see the gasoline station, and you see right on that board, it feels like that's been the more stable thing. And, you know, by my house, there's two things I drive by every day, a gas station where I see gas prices and a bank that's posting mortgage rates. Well, the gas prices have been more stable, but it feels like maybe the mortgage rate is the one that has been jumping a bit more recently.
Yeah, you take a look at the components of inflation and what has been driving it this past year, and energy prices down a little bit from where they were before, so that's kind of helping out on that piece. But the big driver the last 2 years has been used vehicle prices, and then like owner equivalency rent and stuff like that. And part of it is sticky, part of it probably not. You know, used vehicle prices, we saw them spike a year ago because, you know, you couldn't get a new vehicle on the dealership lot. So you overpaid for the used one because you couldn't get a new one. And then you take a look at, you know, owner equivalency rent, which is perhaps more sticky piece of inflation. By the way, owner equivalency rent is like a nebulous concept in and of itself. It's basically like you own your own home, and then what would you pay if you actually had to rent it? Nobody actually pays it, but it's kind of part of the math of the way we do this. And you look at rents and how that they've gone up. And when people sign leases, you know, they sign for like a year or two. They don't sign for a month to month generally. It's a year or two thing. And then you go in and you talk to your employer, say, hey, my rent is up. Maybe that leads to higher pay down the road. And that could be a stickier piece of inflation where used vehicle prices, which was a huge driver last year, that's starting to abate itself.
Yeah, and I think that's across the board on inflation. It's such a great kind of comparison between areas where we'll probably see prices stay high, even as the rate of inflation slows. It doesn't mean prices fall back down. It just means they stop increasing at that rate, compared to some stuff that clearly, you know, has gotten maybe a little elevated and is going to be a bit more volatile. So I think that's a key to the inflation picture. You know, Joel, the big thing we've been keeping an eye on as it relates to kind of the Fed's journey to combat inflation is employment, right? That as long as employment remains fairly strong, we should expect the economy to do okay. More news this week that while maybe it's not as strong, it's still relatively strong.
Yeah, Kyle, and it gets a little disconcerting maybe after a while because you want to see the Fed's actions taking effect, and you're not necessarily seeing that or not in great to a great deal. So the numbers came out from the jobs report, which looks at unemployment. It also looks at the number of hirings for the month of October. And, you know, a couple of the ways that I heard economists describe it is that it showed that the economy no longer is going at 100 miles an hour. It's now down to 85 miles an hour, or that one economist said that it's no longer a white-hot economy. It's just a red-hot economy now. So, and that's, you know, the jobs sector of it. And so we actually saw 261,000 jobs added in October, which outside of the last couple of years is a lot, but it's the slowest pace that we've had since December of 2020. And so, you know, we're still adding jobs. It's starting to go down a little bit. And that's just, you know, part of the story of how, you know, the employment market is still pretty strong, but it's not weakening as much as maybe, you know, those less patient people would want.
You know, and we revised higher last month's job numbers. I think it was a huge revision up, the 315,000. So, you know, go back to your analogy, like we might have been going 100 miles an hour before, now we're down to like 85, but the Federal Reserve is still hoping for like 55 as their target for, you know, speed limit, if you right, if you want right. to say. So there's still more work to be done, which is my point.
The mm-hmm. Wall Street Journal headline was still hiring on all cylinders, you know, a little play on the still firing on all cylinders. So I think, you know, absolutely what we're talking about here is that despite everything the Fed has done, despite all the calls for recession, the economy is continuing to, at a minimum, muddle along and in some places do fairly well. The one, you know, kind of maybe surprising piece of news, and I think there's more noise in this than what many people are willing to kind of recognize, is the unemployment rate ticked up just slightly, moving from 3.5% to 3.7%. But, you know, Joel, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but a much smaller sample in that in terms of actual labor force than what we typically see in jobs reports.
Right. So because of the smaller sample, we'll see more corrections month to month as they, you know, look at all of these numbers. One of the things that I looked at or that I saw in those numbers today was that there's like 5% more people who are unemployed, which is people looking for jobs, right? So a lot of the indicators in the unemployment figures, which are household surveys, a lot of those figures were kind of the same as they were in September, but we saw an uptick in the number of people who were out looking for jobs. And a lot of times that's a good thing for a labor market because it says that people are no longer on the sidelines, that they're more interested in getting out there and actually looking for a job.
And you have no idea how many conversations I have with clients where we talk about the labor market. We talk about the 10 million jobs that are out there and the 5.5 million people looking for work. And the response I get from clients is, well, where are they? Where are all the people that are supposed to be filling these jobs? And I think that's the key, is it's not that they're not out there. It's just maybe they haven't been looking for a little while because they didn't need to. It wasn't economical for them to do it. There was some constraint on them, whether it's childcare or health concerns or, you know, any variety of other things. And I also remind them, because many of them are in the demographic where they're at or near retirement, that's part of the problem as well, that a lot of people have aged out of the workforce.
Right. A lot of people are in that category where they might have lost their job when the pandemic started, and they just didn't, you know, feel motivated to get back into the workforce, or maybe their job is gone, or maybe they want to do something else and they're just not back into it yet. But they also could have some of those constraints about health concerns, or I saw figures today on the number of jobs that are not there anymore in child care and elder care. So if you've got somebody else in your family that you need to take care of and there's nobody to help you do that, then you're staying home even though you might want to go out and work.
And don't forget, too, that we've added, and I don't have the exact numbers, Joel, you could probably tell me, somewhere between 4.5 and 5 million jobs added to the economy this year. So we brought a lot of people in from the sidelines, and that certainly is not a recessionary trend, right? If you're adding 4.5 million people to the workforce, obviously you would expect that they're adding something to the party, right?
Right,
they're either
right.
producing something or providing a service. So certainly not a recessionary trend when you're adding that kind of labor to the
right.
pool.
Think about just since April of 2020, which isn't that long ago, 2.5 years, we've added 23 million jobs. That's a lot of jobs.
And I think this becomes incredibly evident in service sectors, right? When you go to a restaurant and there's not enough servers, so they can't seat the whole restaurant. When you want to take a flight, but they can't get a pilot or they can't get someone to tend the gate, I think it's less obvious in some of the manufacturing areas we talk about, some of the more kind of physical goods things. And we got some data on manufacturing this week, on construction, and especially factory orders. You know, maybe not as big of a part of the economy as they used to be, but still important.
But and a growing part. You know, one of the things that we got from, I mean, one of the groups that was hiring most in October were factories. You know, very surprising a lot of analysts. And again, it's not as big a part of the economy as it used to be, but those are growing. And the other thing that's out there is, we got numbers from the ISM, the Institute for Supply Management, on their manufacturing index, and it was growing. That sector was growing for the 29th month in a row, but at the slowest pace. So again, it's showing this, you know, what we were saying about jobs is that it's still growing, but it's slowing down a little, and that's maybe the effect of the Fed. But we're seeing, because a lot of those, the ISM reports, and they did one on non-manufacturing, the service sector jobs too, and those are based on interviews with executives, and a lot of the executives are saying, and again, to the employment aspect, they're saying, you know, we're getting a little nervous about the economy, that we're starting to see things slow down a little bit, but we're nervous about letting people go. Because we know the demographics out there aren't real kind right now, and we're afraid of letting people go and then needing people back again, and it's going to be hard to replace them.
And costly to replace them, because to attract the talent you want to attract, you may have to pay a little more than you paid those workers that you just let go. So, you know, I think overall a pretty good reason to think that the economy is in a place where it can weather some of the storm the Fed has created. It can weather some of the typical pitfalls of this environment without, you know, having the lasting impact that we typically see from the Fed kind of pulling the punch bowl away from the party a little too quick. And so overall, it's one of the reasons I think why we remain optimistic, you know, with that word caution tossed in, because there's a lot we need to get through still before we get to some of the other side of, you know, the Fed finally stabilizing, the markets finally recognizing that maybe that's the path forward.
I'll share a quick story about trying to explain what the Federal Reserve is trying to do in raising rates. And this is actually something I was telling my dad, who's a recreational pilot. He doesn't have much appetite for economics, but he understands like pilot stuff. So I was trying to explain an example of like the Federal Reserve is trying to land this big giant jumbo plane on a narrow runway in a stiff crosswind. And I said, look, if you got to land this big old plane in a heavy crosswind, you got to come in fast and hard and just take the crosswind out of the equation. And he smiled and he chuckled because he got my analogy. And he said, that's not entirely true. He said, if you really got to land a big plane and you got danger left and right and a stiff crosswind, first thing you do is you tell your passenger, buckle up. It could be bumpy. And two, you crab walk it in. You slip it in, which means the entire time you're on final approach, the nose of that plane is pointing somewhere else besides right down center of the runway, and it's not until the last minute where the pilot can correct and land the plane. And I tell you what, that feels a lot like what we're doing now or experiencing with the Federal Reserve. It feels like the nose is pointing some other different direction, but it's still possible to land this plane and squeak it in there. Whether they do that or not is yet to be seen, but it does remain possible.
Just buckle up.
Yeah, buckle up. And the few pilots I know all say that any landing you walk away from is a good landing. So I'm going to hope that that's true of kind of us walking in the current economy. Well, thank you all for listening. We enjoy doing the program. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.